Well, thanks everyone for coming. It's really great to see so many people here in this fantastic space in our wonderful library in Melbourne. When I first had the idea for a law and social change event, I thought, who else would be interested in that topic? It was very encouraging that Nick, Julian and Simon were all enthusiastic early on when I pitched it to them. So I thought, well, at the very least, there'll be four of us and, you know, they're interesting guys and we can have a good conversation. But as it turns out, here we all are and the room is full. In fact, we sold out a week ago, so you did well. So clearly the four of us are not alone. And I'm really looking forward to a great conversation tonight. Before we start, I'd just like to formally acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. So let's kick off. The format tonight is pretty simple. Nick and then Simon will each give a short presentation on their ideas on law and social change. And Julian will then moderate the discussion that will follow. And he's got his own thoughts on the topic as well, and so he'll throw those in. And who knows, next year maybe we'll call it the satire and social change event. And we'll end the evening with drinks and nibbles at around sort of 7:30, 7:45. Just a couple of quick matters of housekeeping. We are audio and in fact video recording the event. So please let Julian know before you make a comment or ask a question if you don't want to be recorded, and we'll take that into account when we do the editing. Otherwise, your voice will end up on the Pilch website. And can you please turn your mobile phones off or to silent? And in fact, let's all take a moment to do that now. Also, when you're participating in the discussion, please speak into the microphone. That means you have to hold it in front of your mouth and not down in front of your stomach or in the air or up here, sort of talk into the microphone. Julian will remind you of that too, so please try and think of that unless you want to be embarrassed. Please keep your questions and comments concise so that other people can have a chance to have a say. On the seats around you, you'll find a response form and a pen in case you didn't have a pen. We'd love to hear your thoughts at the end of the night. You might want to jot down thoughts as the evening unfolds so that you can ask questions at the end. So just be ready to participate in that way. And it'll be a good night. So a bit of background. In the early stages of imagining the event, it was in fact called a lecture. And my idea was to find one wise and learned person and have them tell us what they thought about lawyers and social change. But then I thought about that a bit more and I thought, that actually sounds pretty boring. So then I thought, why don't I have three wise and learned people instead? That runs the risk of, in fact, being three times as boring. And in any case, the topic is really too complex and too interesting for a one-person monologue, no matter how wise the people. So the idea of a dialogue really emerged from that thinking. And I'm sure it won't be boring, given the calibre, dare I say the wisdom, of our speakers and presenters tonight. And I'd like to welcome them. They're all pretty well known, so rather than reading out their CVs, which you can, as I did, get from Google, I thought I would just tell you three things that you may not know about them. So our first speaker is Nick Francis. Nick used to be a stockbroker, and he is currently still an ordained Anglican priest. He was awarded an MBE in his native England for his work to provide assistance and employment opportunities to vulnerable people through the Furniture Resource Centre. And he's the founder and executive chairman of Cool Energy International, which he established in 2007 to build on his efforts to reverse climate change, begun by a company he established in 2004. Then we have Simon Shaikh, who's national director of advocacy organisation GetUp. He was born and raised in Sydney, and he told me earlier today that his values were really strongly shaped by being a young carer of his mother, who has a mental illness. Simon graduated in economics and then worked in the New South Wales Treasury until 2008 when he joined GetUp. And in 2007, He was Australia's Commonwealth Youth Representative to the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Uganda. So maybe you can ask him about that. Yeah, it sounds like a total junket. Although Uganda and junket, maybe not so sure. And Julian Morrow will moderate our discussion. Julian is very well known, but perhaps he didn't know that his middle names are Francis Xavier. And so that might explain his description of himself as a lapsed Catholic. Julian's also a lapsed lawyer. Before becoming a comedian, he graduated in law at the University of Sydney and he worked in employment law at the law firm that's now called Blake Dawson. In contrast to his lack of commitment to in the previous categories, he's maintained his allegiance to Sydney, where he still lives, the city of his birth, where he lives with his wife and their young son. So please make them welcome. Thanks. So, as for me, I'm an idealist. I think that change is possible. In fact, I have got the T-shirt to prove it. Very special, very beautiful. Change we can believe in. And it's even got a picture of Obama on the front. So, I'm a paid-up member of the Change is Possible Club. So I guess it's no surprise that my life's journey has seen me work in organisations that tackle injustice, World Vision, and now at the Public Interest Law Clearinghouse. And mostly my path has been in the law and with lawyers. But the longer that I've been on that path, the more questions I have about how to really change things. Some of you in the room are lawyers and you might be able to remember doing litigation 101 or evidence 101 in law school. You'll remember that the first rule of cross-examination is to never ask a question unless you know the answer. Well, tonight is actually all about questions that we don't know the answer to. Questions like, what really is social change? What are we talking about? How do you make it happen? And most interestingly to the lawyers in the room, do lawyers have a role to play? My little sister is a social worker, and she said, and I quote, I must say, I am of the belief that it is actually youth workers that change the world. Maybe she's right. So I wonder what your questions are, and I'm looking forward to hearing them. So I welcome Nick up to the podium, and he'll be followed by Simon. Thanks.
Hi, good evening. I'd also like to add my acknowledgement that we're still on the land of the Wurundjeri people. And of course, if you ever wanted to an example of why, you know, it is so important if you want social policy and you want change in the relationship between the law, you'd actually have to say that the only rights and the only way that the Aboriginal people in this country have been treated well is when the law has actually carved them out that right. So from where I start, and certainly as someone who's only lived in this country 11 years, it's a good place by acknowledging that this is the land of the Wurundjeri people and of the Kulin Nation. I'm going to just... I've got 15 minutes to be provocative, and that's going to be really difficult for me. I've not done that for a while. So I'm going to try and be a little bit provocative, and I thought, well, the way of doing that is to really just ignore facts for 15 minutes, forget facts. Just, you know, be absolutely emotional about this. You know, let yourself go, Nick, you know, go crazy. And then I thought, but, you know, and just make it up. Just make it up and make a case out of nothing. And then I thought, well, actually, that's what you do every day. So maybe I should think of doing something different. So I want to just tell three little stories. And really, it's just the stories about the power of law. You see, I've spent most of my life either in business or in the not-for-profit sector. I've most of my life been doing that, doing business or working in the not-for-profit sector to create social change. So it's a, you know, as a social entrepreneur, my use of the market has always been to deliver some kind of other outcome. So I'm really interested in, you know, how you get that and how you do it. But one of the things that I found is it's incredibly difficult to create change. You know, when I was at the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence and its CEO for 5 years, we employed 700 people, had a turnover of $40 million. We'd started in North Fitzroy, just across the road from the flats. When Father Tucker started it 70 years ago, there were 80% unemployment in North Fitzroy. If you go across the road now and ask in the flats what the unemployment is, it's 80%. Now, the difference was when the Brotherhood started, he was doing it and he was earning nothing and there was only one of him. 70 years later, there were 400 of us and I was earning $125,000 a year. Somebody was doing well out of poverty. Now, that's frightening. You know, I mean, that's a very contentious point, isn't it? It's like, you know, how do we create change? And do we create change? And do we get into places where we're comfortable? And then do we consider hard enough whether we're part of the problem or part of the solution? And are we, if we see, if we even dare think that we might be part of the problem, are we willing to change? Or actually, are we hooked in to doing it the way that we do it and liking the way we do it? Now, I also would say it was 5 years working at the Brotherhood of Science was, you know, an extraordinary honor in my life to be working around 400 people that every single day got up because they really wanted to improve the lives of others. That doesn't mean, though, that every day we managed it. So three brief stories. One is at the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence. We just did lots and lots of different things. But one day I went to work, and as I'm walking through to work, I got there early. It was about just before 8 o'clock in the morning. And we're in North Fitzroy, and as I walk across the steps, I'm trying to get into them, but there's a woman, young woman, she's early 20s. She sat on the steps, and she's shooting up. So she's got a needle, and she's going to put it in her arm, and I'm just about to step over, and I'm going, oh, you know, what do you do? And I've spent 20 years, at that point, I spent 15 years working with homeless people. You know, I've spent a lot of time with people who have been rehabilitated from drugs, in drugs, people with AIDS. I'm thinking, this is cool, except it's on my way. It's my office, you know, it's the step. And there was something extraordinarily confronting about that. What do I do, you know? And so I said to her, look, I don't think it's safe to do that here. There's going to be a lot of people coming in. Why don't you just come inside? So at that point, I've just taken the job. I'm Father Nick Francis, MBE, CEO of the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence, taking heroin user off the street and putting inside. And I'm thinking, well, I can't leave her in reception. And just inside, for those of you who know the Brotherhood building, there used to be a chapel. I'm thinking the only place where we're not going to get people walking by right now is the chapel. So now Father Nick's taking user into room and saying, this will be all right. Now, personally, as a priest who didn't really believe in God, I thought it was a perfect place to be. It's quiet, it's safe. You know, this is the right spot to be doing this activity. But, you know, can you imagine the Herald Sun story? This was not the risk that you should be taking for an organisation that relies on credibility. But then Father Tucker never would have started an organisation, I think, to do anything else. So I then think this is absolutely incredible. So I go upstairs and say, we got to, you know, can somebody come and help? You know, and I'm chatting to this girl. I'm chatting to her. I spent a couple of hours. I'm chatting to her. And I'm saying, you know, what's the thing? She says, I want to get off. I can't get off. I can't get off because I can't get on a methadone program. And I'm, you know, I know about these things. I know about these things because every single day I'm the CEO of this organization. But she can't get on a methadone program. I'm saying, that's ridiculous. And I know the CEO of the drugs center just around the corner. So I pick up the phone and say, excuse me, can we just get this girl on a methadone program? She said, well, you know, we can try, but, you know, you won't get one. And I'm saying, well, what do you mean? Methadone is a legal right. If you get a prescription, you can just get on a methadone program. You know, you've got to find a pharmacist that will take it. And actually, pharmacists won't take them all, and they don't like them. Most pharmacists don't like having users come to their shop because it puts off the other customers. I'm saying, hold on a minute. She's a methadone user. She wants to get off. She's just told me that if she doesn't score again today, she's going to go back to St. Kilda. She's 20 years of age. She's this young kid, and she says, well, I've got to go back and work tonight. So I've got a young woman who wants to get off who's now going to go back on the streets, might die tonight, and it's all too bloody close. I'm meant to be the CEO. I'm just meant to be safe. Can't get on a program. So I create a campaign, get thousands and thousands of letters, go and see John Thwaites, who's the minister at the moment, sit down with him. He says, will you stop asking for a campaign? It's their legal right. I said, but nobody can get it. He said, well, I can't do anything about that. Pharmacists don't like it. There's an action there. Somebody needs to say, if you want a bloody pharmacy shop and you want to sell drugs and you want to do it in Brighton, you've got to be bloody well willing to have a Brighton kid who's a user come in and get the prescription they need so they don't have to go down the road and sell their body on the streets. Now, I couldn't do it politically. I had 400 employees, hundreds of thousands of people willing to sign bits of paper, but actually nothing changed. I tried for 2 days. That girl came back the next day. She came back the next day for help. I never got her on a methadone program. I don't know whether she's alive or dead. There's incredible opportunity for using the law to create rights in places where there should be rights. It should not be okay to go to the Mercy Hospital with somebody who doesn't speak English and actually you need a D&C because actually you just had a miscarriage, but not get that information because actually the Mercy Hospital don't like the thought that you can have that. The fact that it's a legal right and they take federal money to actually deliver those services is not appropriate in my view. So somebody should sue them, I think. Maybe you can't, don't know. The other thing is that I'm in the climate change space. And in the climate change space, there is nothing happening in America. I started a business. We started 3 years ago. We were doing mass action on climate change. It was doing really, really well. And then all of a sudden, 6 months before Copenhagen, everyone stopped because they thought, God, it's all going to change. So we've got to stop doing activity. We'll wait. So I stopped doing anything in the world. We were doing action. We're just an action business. Action on climate change. Doing things. Not talking about it. Not discussing. Not campaigning. Just action. So the action stopped. So the money dried up. The profits we made for the first 2 years, I started now spending those profits. That was about $6 million and 2.5 years ago. There's now none left. Nothing has happened since then because there is no target. And particularly there's no action because of two countries that are really behaving very poorly in this space. One is us and the other is the Americans. Seems like we're a very different size, but actually we're very important in this debate and we haven't acted. What's fascinating is in America, there was no action and nothing to happen until... I thought I could have a little bit of fact here. I'm not very good at facts. But so the background to this is Section 202A... in brackets one, of the Clean Air Act in the USA requires that the EPA set emission standards for any air pollutant. However, in 2003, the EPA made two determinations. The EPA lacked authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases for climate change purposes. Even if the EPA did have such authority, it would decline to set global greenhouse gas emissions standards for vehicles. They say they did that under pressure from ExxonMobil. I don't know that that would be true. Interesting that Massachusetts versus Environmental Protection Agency in 2007 overturned that. And now because of that act, you can legally enforce action on climate change. You can't create a carbon credit, but there is action and more significant action and a clean tech industry in America that we do not have here. Why? Legal action. We have not been able to get that politically. Obama said, there are two things I'm coming to do. He's only made one of them and he's now losing his job. You know, it's like he's not managed the other one, but the law managed it. So my last bit of story, I'm doing really well for time here. You're okay. We're going to be in. Last thing is I started this company called Cool Energy. It actually does mass action on climate. Okay, and we thought up something. It's never been done in the world. All the carbon trading has mostly been in India and China, and it's all been about large industrial organizations that create very potent gases, collecting them, burning them off, and creating carbon credits. It's been a great success because countries like ours that did sign up can't do their own emissions internally, and they have to go and buy them from developing countries, which cleans up Developing Countries Act at the cost of sluggish developed countries. Nice. That makes perfect sense to me. Good policy. So the trouble is, though, it was one of its real goals was to do something about anti-poverty. Now, the trouble with the clean development mechanism and creating carbon credits is it was only working in industrial areas and it was only working in China and India. So, but there is a way that you can do it. It's just no one had done it because it's really expensive. So I spent $5 million in the last 2 years developing the first ever United Nations credits that can be created and then lumped together in an individual's home. And President Calderon, just before the launch of Copenhagen COP16, which is now happening in Cancun in Mexico in a month's time, will announce that we're going to change 45 million light globes. That's half of the light globes of the poor people in Mexico. As a consequence of doing that, that poor people will save about a month's income every single year in terms of not having to buy energy that they did with their previous lighting. It means for those poor people, it's about $350 million aggregated a year saving. Because electricity is so expensive, though, it's a direct saving to the Mexican government who subsidized their energy at 50%. So they also, the Mexican government, save $350 million a year in direct subsidy out of Treasury. That's $700 million into Mexico, split between the poorest people, bottom 50%, and the Mexican government. The whole US aid budget last year into Mexico was $30 million. 700 million little carbon trading thing from a company in Australia who aren't yet in a country that signed up to Kyoto. Oh, ratified. The interesting thing about it, and where I struggle then with the law, is that we put that together. The World Bank sold our credits. They have a carbon trading arm. They also have a debt arm. And they sold our credits. They never spoke to us about it. They sold them to the Danish government. The Danish government went through Treasury and said, these are great credits. These are the first credits. They're the first credits in the world called gold standard, which means they don't only do the environment, they really care for the people of that environment. So these are first gold standards. Well, lots of people wanted some. The World Bank sold them to the Danish government. The Danish Treasury said, yes, we'll buy them. And I, the Danish Treasurer, someone in Treasury came up to me and said, thank you, I've just heard you speak. We've bought your credits. I said, no, you haven't. I've just sold them to a power company called Eneco. And he said, no, we bought them. I said, no, you haven't. I've sold them to a power company. He said, we just bought them from the World Bank. It's just gone through Treasury. I'm saying, you haven't. They're mine. It's my company. I paid for the POA. They're my credits. You're not getting them. I found out this week that the World Bank is currently loaning the Mexican government the money for them to put into the light globes. They are also the commercial advisors on how to get the credits out of the country. They are also currently advising the Mexican government that maybe they don't want to do and take the credits from the organization that's put this program together and invested in it, and that maybe they might want to do it, and the World Bank will create a new United Nations protocol for delivering these, and that they would get the credits. I got really upset about this, because obviously, apart from my house, my life, and my kids and all those kind of things, it was actually the role of the World Bank is actually to build commerce in developing countries. So I phoned up a friend of mine who's an international lawyer to say, I really would like to do something about this because it doesn't seem fair. And he said, well, the trouble is the World Bank is owned by nation states and it's above the law.